Hey guys, this is Kat. Katsumoto, and I'm doing this audiobook review today. The book is On Grand Strategy, On Grand Strategy, by John Lewis Gaddis. Basically, I'm just going to go through and talk about some cool parts I highlighted. We'll see how this goes. Great sound. So as you can probably tell, I'm not really, I'm much more comfortable writing than talking, and that I can, edit everything I say, and plus I can have like weird, I typically always have weird sounds playing in the background because of immersion. So I'm really not used to, there not being, whatever sounds playing, but here we go. Let's try this out really quick. Okay. So there's a really cool part here where he compares King Philip of Spain to Queen Elizabeth. Of course, I guess King Philip launched the Spanish Armada. They wanted to re-Catholicize England, especially the British Isles, whatever. I guess Ireland was already Catholic, but whatever. Anyway, let's not get into it. The point is, he compares King Philip to Queen Elizabeth, and he says King Philip rushes from crisis to crisis, rarely resting, never fully in control. He's whacking moles, and they pop up everywhere. In contrast, that Queen Elizabeth, she refuses to hurry. She'll whack when she has to. The raised hand can indeed remove a head, but she sets times and places. She resists unnecessary expenditures of resources, energy, reputation, and, unusually in a monarch, virginity. The king, looking to heaven, venerates King Philip. The queen, feet on earth, calculates. It's important for us. Again, we want to avoid unnecessary expenditures of our energy, right? And she sets times and places. That's a time boxing lesson right there, I think. I keep returning to like the same things, time boxing, forced concentration. These are powerful ideas. And actually, I wanted to talk about this earlier, but the reason, so I'm a pacifist, right? So why do I talk so much about war? Well, I don't know. First of all, almost all our entertainment, at least, I don't watch chick flicks, so like I don't watch romantic comedies, right? So almost all our entertainment is grounded, or is somehow related to war. So it's a thing, And if I were to tell you I'm gonna make a movie and there'll be a war in it, you'd be like, yeah, whatever. But if suddenly we talk about it in terms of lessons we can learn, it's somehow, oh, that's violent. Well, the truth is they're both violent, and I don't think. It may or may not be wrong, but it's useful. There are a lot of useful metaphors there, because war is something that we pursue with great. We tend to pursue, peoples and nations have tended to pursue with great. I want to say alacrity, but I'm not actually sure if I know what that word means. Let me find out. Yeah, alacrity is not quite the word I mean, but we pursue it with a great intensity, right? With a great deal of focus, and. What I'm saying really is it's important for us to pursue anything we do pursue with that kind of focus. Otherwise, why bother doing it at all? I'm not saying, if it's not worth doing something intensely, is it worth doing at all? Right? Which is not to say, do it perfectly. I'm just saying do it intensely, right? Perfection and intensity are actually quite different. Although ironically, intensity will get you closer to perfection in less time, but that's neither here nor there. The point is, they're useful lessons to learn, and we're here learning them. More on Queen Elizabeth. Elizabeth readily yielded authority. She didn't even design her own palace. She simply took over or borrowed the ones she fancied. If God didn't want to do everything, why should she? That's really cool, and this is again the idea of us using ideas from wherever they come. So screw it. Yeah, that's a good idea. They use it. Like we don't have to reinvent the wheel, right? It's this really amazing. Here it is. I was doing some traveling, and I saw this yacht, and it's called the Atessa IV, Roman numeral 4, and it's owned by this guy Dennis Washington, and it's really weird looking because it looks like a commercial ship. It's weird, but it's a yacht. It's still a yacht. There's a helicopter on it and everything. But I was like, what's the deal with this? Anyway, I went to. So I saw this thing in real life, and I went to look up some more information on it, because when you get like yachts that big, there's actually lots of publicly available information on them. In fact, think you can actually track their location by GPS anywhere in the world at any time. It's kind of cool. Like, it's publicly available. Anyway, so it turns out this yacht was actually a merchant ship that he repurposed. And so this guy, Dennis Washington, he's like a chemical engineer by training, billionaire entrepreneur, right? And he repurposed a commercial yacht. Like, he didn't... He has the money. His net worth is up, but is just under $6 billion, according to Wikipedia. So he has the money to, you know, custom build a yacht exactly the way he wants. But he's like, he actually finds it easier to take... He found it much easier to take... It's not the first time he's done this either, to take yachts that already exist and repurpose them. And not only do I respect the heck out of that, I really understand that. Like, it's actually... It's hard just doing stuff from completely from scratch, right? It's rough, and I don't think, and first of all, even when we think we're doing stuff from scratch, we're actually just unconsciously borrowing things. So he's like, no, I'm not even gonna unconsciously borrow. I'm gonna borrow consciously. Like, I'm gonna just take this. I've got this shell, this yacht I already like, and I'm gonna, you know, I'll customize from there. It's great to start from this foundation. So when you find like ideas, like in my case, it was. Well, I found some Polish guys who learned English really well. So it's like, well, hey, that's an idea. Maybe I can use this for Japanese. That's what those Polish guys were, the Anti-Moon guys, Tomas and those guys. And applying those ideas to Japanese is what those ideas are what became the core of the, you know, so-called AJAP method. But yeah, so I think we have this cult of originality, this idea that, you know, we got to... You know, you just like, you know, abuse enough laudanum and cocaine and opium and alcohol, and then suddenly, you know, these Greek demigoddess muses come and like give you this idea, and it's just magic. And we have these, again, these quasi-religious kind of, and very, we have a lot of magical thinking around creation, creativity. And it's wrong. It's wrong, not just because it hurts us, but it's incorrect, and it's not useful. And so yeah, borrow a palace, just take over a palace, and you know, stick your own furniture in where you want to. But you don't have to. So you only need to create when it matters to you. Like you, it's not even AJAP. It's not customizing for the sake of customizing. It's customizing for the sake of, well, this sucks, I don't want to do it, or this sucks and it's boring, so I'm not going to do it. I'm going to find a way around it, or find a better way to do it. Find a way, you know, not to do it. You know, whatever the case may be. But that's the idea there. Here's a really cool part about Queen Elizabeth. He goes, she'd arrange the courtiers and counselors around her, the diplomats and envoys, the kings and powers of the continent, and such in an elaborate interlocked design, so cunningly and delicately balanced that each part should counteract another, and she herself should always be free. And this definitely makes it sound like it's grand design. It's grand in that the scale's big, but there's plenty of room for us to do this kind of thing in our own lives. You know, we just you could call it the Homer Simpson principle, right? You get everything that in that couch just right where it's your groove and you're comfortable. You get, you know, your tools, your methods. You just tweak everything just the way you want it. Yeah, and so that, you know, you're always comfortable, you're always having fun, you're always enjoying your learning process. And so Gaddison contrasts this with King Philip, you know, who insisted, as an absolute monarch, he need not acknowledge any temporal superior on this earth. But, you know, then Gaddis continues, how could Philip have no superior but be paralyzed by constraints? His family, the ubiquitous Habsburgs, had long privileged dynastic ties over geographic, economic, or cultural affinities. They conquered, it was said, by marrying. As a result, Philip ruled and depended on revenues from a patchwork of peoples owing him little loyalty. Non-contiguous boundaries compounded the problem, as did the king's dislike of delegating authority. The king was at war somewhere for all but 6 months of his 43 years on the throne. He didn't do badly. Philip lost none of the territories Charles V left him. Spain wouldn't give up the Netherlands until half a century after Philip's death. Portugal, with its overseas possessions, would remain Spanish for 6 decades. Even Philip's debts, about which he complained constantly, and on which he defaulted repeatedly, may have been, by modern standards, sustainable. The thing about Philip, though, is that, you know, as again quoting Gaddis, he failed to see incompatibles, and hence the need to pursue certain objectives at the expense of others. The king resisted prioritizing ends. End quote, I guess. I'm not saying quote, end quote, and that's, you know what, you'll figure it out. which parts are me and which parts are Gaddis. It'll make sense. The point is, it's hard to imagine now just how powerful Spain was in the 16th century. Like, unquestionably, the most powerful state in the world. Like, just by far. I would definitely argue more powerful than, say, the US is now, definitely. But they were like, it's weird, like, the Spanish Empire, it was like, you know how, like, larger stars larger than the sun, they have more fuel, right? More nuclear fuel. They actually have shorter lifespans than our sun, even though they're larger. They've got more fuel. Why is their lifespan shorter? Well, they spend more fuel more quickly. So, same thing with the Spanish. This was a profligate empire, right? They just wasted that. You know, they like stole so much gold out from South and Central America, but they wasted it. And the point of the story being, even if you're King Philip, even if you're Bill Gates, you're Jeff Bezos, you're Warren Buffett, you're what's the Oracle guy's name? Crap, how could I forget? Larry Ellison. Even if you have what seems to a quote unquote normal person, like, you know, infinite amounts of money, infinite sums of money, infinite power, you don't. Your power actually is finite. We're all finite, all of us, at any time. So we're all bound by these rules, and this is probably why a book like On Grand Strategy is actually applicable to even people like us. You know, even people like us, we're not literally commanding armies. We're arguably barely in control of ourselves, and yet we're still commanding something. We're in command of, you know, resources. We're in command of, and we're in command of what options we select, what choices we make in life. And so that's why these ideas come into play. Anyway, so like I was saying, his resources were finite. And finite means you need to make choices. You need to prioritize. I mean, this is going to sound, I don't know, it doesn't sound sexy, but you need to make trade-offs, right? Like, you need to make decisions, which means, and the decision, again, means cutting some things off. It means saying no. It means actually cutting a great many things off. It means cutting off everything but the things that matter most. But, you know, he was too cool for school. He was too cool to prioritize, and he ended up, you know, as Gaddis mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned it here, but Gaddis talks about how King Philip himself didn't lose any, yeah, I did mention it, right? King Philip himself didn't lose any of the territories Charles V left him, but, you know, after his reign, they went away, which I think says something, right? It says something about, I'm not going to do that. It may seem harsh to blame someone for things that happened after their death, but I think it's fair to say, like, he set off/continued a chain of events that had effects, that had posthumous effects, and, you know, just not having priorities is going to do that too. It doesn't matter how much or how little power you have if you waste it. So the thing is to be sensible at any time, or whether you feel like you have very little power, or whether you feel like you're king of the world, literally and figuratively, you still need to be smart about it. And not just like this miser, like, oh, be smart about it. Oh, don't spend any of your. I mean, I do joke about being a miser about with your energy, but yeah, you need to be economical with it, and that means not wasting it on, like, BS that you hate, right? Like, why are you gonna don't do that? Like, you if you seriously hate doing something, or more likely you hate the way you're doing something, then don't spend energy on doing things that way. You want to change the way you do things. So then Gaddis contrasts King Philip with Queen Elizabeth. So King Philip, the king resisted prioritizing ends. With Queen Elizabeth, he's like relishing opposites. The queen was constant only in her patriotism. her insistence on keeping ends within means, and her determination, a requirement of pivoting, never to be pinned down. Elizabeth balanced revenues and expenses during most of her reign, even running a surplus in its second and third decades. We don't usually connect fiscal responsibility with lightness of being, but in Elizabeth they aligned. Lightness allowed flirtation, which cost less than obligation, whether to suitors or to their realms. It facilitated strategic mischief. When short of funds, Elizabeth allowed her navy to raid Philip's treasure ships returning from America. Perhaps, she suggested in response to his protests, they'd been the victims of pirates. She balanced purposefulness with imagination, guile, humor, timing, and an economy in movement. She, Queen Elizabeth, without visible effort, retained the initiative in all she did. He, King Philip, exhausted himself, regaining it in one place while losing it somewhere else. Regaining initiative in one place while losing it somewhere else. It's important because King Philip failed to be selective. He tried to be exhaustive. He wanted to be, you know, large and in charge everywhere all the time. And that meant he was large and in charge nowhere at any of the time. Where is the Spanish Empire now? It's kind of nowhere. And, continuing with Gallus, she, Queen Elizabeth, deftly turned adversaries against each other. He, King Philip, ponderously united them against himself. She, running a poor state, kept it solvent. He, running a rich one, begged and borrowed. And so there we go. Big stars versus small stars again, right? Like actual celestial bodies. This part's really cool. I don't think it's actually relevant to us, but it's just kind of cool. Elizabeth's navy could intercept Spanish ships anywhere along their long route, leaving her free, because distance delayed communications, to avow or disavow its actions. Here's another really cool quote. This is the Duke of Alba speaking to the Duke of Alba, commander of King Philip's armies in the Netherlands. And he's kind of finding King Philip's ideas a bit impractical, a bit loony, but whatever, and not whatever. And he goes to him, "Even though the principal means must come from God, as your majesty very virtuously and piously suggests, it seems necessary to examine what human resources would be needed to carry out your wishes." It's kind of one of those backhanded, like, your ideas are great, they're just kind of crap, so your head's in the clouds and you're full of it. So, okay, that's great that you've got your churchy thing, it's going to work, but we need to figure out how, like, we're actually going to do this. And I think that's important. Actually, this is important to us in a way, not just like in a being like smugly secular way, but more in terms of I think it's very easy for us. Which us am I talking about? I don't know. I don't know if it's a thing with English speakers or not, but just I don't think it's a thing. It's limited to English speakers, but getting wrapped up wherever it's from, we have this thing where we get wrapped up in principles, like in ideas, and so you'll get people who are like, "Well, I'm doing Asian method, or I'm doing this method, I'm doing that method, right?" And they're like, "Well, this is what the method says." Like, it becomes dogma to them. It's like, "Well, no, just okay. These ideas are there, and they're good ideas, but it's also got like what do you have going for you?" You probably know this already if you're listening to this. You're in pretty deep, I think. But I think it's important not to catch religion over, you know, ideas that where you're trying to over methods. These are just practical tools. It's not something you want to be dogmatic about. It's not something you want to be really attached to. It's a tool, and it's the time. Like, even I love SRS, but if something better came along than SRS, that'd be it. That would be it. That's it. We'd part ways. It just happens to be a great tool. I still it's one of the best tools we have. Even now, as far as we've come, we've come a long way in many ways, and in some ways, and in other ways we haven't. And so, it's a great tool. I use it every day. I'm not attached to it for the sake of being attached to it. I'm attached to it for the sake of it's a good. For the sake of it works really right. And that's not a so-called value judgment. That's just a. Just a practical choice. It's like saying, I don't know, I like my thermos because it keeps my chai hot, you know. But if If chai could magically heat itself all the time, then I would change away from thermoses. Okay, so moving on. Here's a really cool quote from Gallus. The English didn't defeat the Armada, but they wore it down, which amounted to the same thing. This is similar to the idea of you don't learn a language, you get used to it. It's like you almost just wear you run out of you run out of you wear the language down in a way, in a weird way, right? You make the language run out of curveballs to throw. You're like, yeah, I know that word, I know that one. You just wear away at it. Just shave it down till there's always gonna be stuff. There's always going to be stuff you don't know, and we're always creating new knowledge. But it's gonna be, it's going to be rarer and rarer in what you read. And so yeah, so, just one thing at a time. You pick one thing, shave that off. Like, yeah, I know this one, I know this one, I know this one. And yeah, it's like a war of attrition, I guess, in its own way. I don't like the term war of attrition because that makes me think of. Makes you think of World War One and just industrial scale stupidity. But I like this idea. Yep, you wear down the opponent using whatever tools you have, whether it's pirates, the North Sea, timing, make them weather, all these things, or in your case, just like a steady persistence and a bucket that does not leak. By which I mean. Your SRS, because you learn new words, but you also don't forget the ones you learned before. That's huge. I see so many people. I don't even tell them. I'm cruel that way. Like I don't try to push on people in my personal life. But I see so many people who they're struggling. They're trying to learn, and they're not getting ahead because they, by the time they've learned new stuff, they've forgotten the old stuff. So they're learning. It's not self-reinforcing. It's not building, right? There's no build-up. There's no snowballing. Yeah, too bad for them, but good for you. So again, the English didn't defeat the Armada, but they wore it down, which amounted to the same thing. Reliant throughout their voyage, this is the Spanish Armada, on supplies taken on weeks earlier in Coruna, with no possibility now of replenishment in any friendly port. Half the men who embarked for England died, most from wrecks, starvation, or disease. The toll may have been 15,000. The English, in contrast, lost only the 8 vessels sacrificed to the flames at Calais, and about 150 men. And so here, Gaddis, and then he kind of slams Philip. He's just slamming the guy, poor guy. he goes, so basically, Philip's like, I hope that God has not permitted so much evil. Philip wrote after the first reports of the disaster reached him. For everything has been done for his service. And then he goes on. Soon, though, he was planning a new invasion, convinced that God, by inflicting adversity, had only been testing him. Should I do it like a bad Spanish accent? I undertake to deal with everything necessary to achieve all this. I shall never fail to stand up for the cause of God. Augustine, of course, had made a similar argument, but what God would test, he'd insisted, was proportionality in aligning ends with means. There was never, in Augustine, an injunction indiscriminately to expend earthly lives and treasure for heavenly purposes. This is really important. There was never an injunction indiscriminately to expend earthly lives and treasure for heavenly purposes. This is important for us, and we're speaking obviously purely in earthly terms. Earthly terms. Since there's nothing in this world that's of infinite value, really. It's a dangerous thing to say, but yeah, I mean, pretty much. There's nothing that's of infinite value. So, I guess life itself is kind of high, but okay, whatever. Beyond, let's say, life itself, there's nothing in this world that's of infinite value. So, there's no point in expending infinite amounts of energy to acquire anything, right? So even if you had infinite amounts of energy, which you don't, but even if you had infinite resources, there'd be no point expending. There'd be a stupid trade. It would be like buying a pair of Bose headphones for infinity dollars, right? Like, I mean, they're good headphones, but they're not worth infinite sums of money, right? So, that's important to us. It's an important lesson to us in being economical with our energy, which it seems it's contradictory, but on the surface, but it's not like so. So what we're saying with time boxing, you want to limit the amount of time you spend on something. So you're putting a limit on it, but yet within that time, you just go balls to the wall, right? You spend all your energy in that time on it, all your energy within that time, not all your energy period, right? So be economical, be discriminate, be judicious. And even Philip's advisors are trying to like get him to see this. Another quote from Gaddis: "If God had placed your majesty under an obligation to remedy all the troubles of the world," Philip's private secretary suggested in 1591, 3 years after the Spanish Armada, "he would have given you the money and strength to do so." But you know, Philip wasn't having it. Gaddis continues: "Philip resorted to what Parker calls spiritual blackmail. When warned that his objectives exceeded his capabilities, the king would claim that those doing the warning themselves lacked faith. God would close the gap. When God didn't, Philip insisted that he would remain faithful, even if God's attention had wandered. God did indeed test Philip, but Philip didn't put himself beneath testing God." Anyway, I thought it was funny. This isn't to say you don't have big goals. I want you to have crazy big goals. Those are like just ridiculously big. Like I'm going to space, whatever it is. Like make it big. Then within that, you take very, very, very sensible, almost unsexy but fun and easy and simple and real and straightforward actions. So I'm gonna get so good at Japanese that people think I'm a native speaker. That may seem like a crazy goal, but to you, it may seem like that. I'd argue it's not, but from experience. But let's say it seems like a crazy goal. So you have that goal, but then within that, you're like, great, well, I'm just gonna take it one word at a time. We're gonna look through a document today. We're gonna find a word I don't know. We'll learn that word. Rinse, repeat type thing. Just very, very concrete, very real, very sensible, very very step by step. Probably a word for that. I can't think of it right now. This next part here, I'm not sure how much it applies to us, but I just like it so much. It's cool. This is a cool book. It's just a cool book. Certainty never required haste. From the moment Elizabeth became queen, the historian A.N. Wilson, A.N. Wilson wrote a really good biography on Hitler, so there's that. Anyway, has pointed out, her advisors and courtiers had been urging her to make decisions, to be Catholic or to be Protestant, to marry, to fight a decisive and expensive war in England or the Low Countries. In almost all cases, Elizabeth had dithered, Hamlet-like, and dithering had been, if not the right policy, then at least not the wrong policy. For Elizabeth, like Hamlet, could see the calamitous effects of too great a precision and too great a decisiveness in political life. End quote. There's another cool part here. He goes, Elizabeth used dithering, which looks irresponsible, in something like the same way, to lure people into thinking she was dumb. Okay, that part's not quite relevant to us, but the calamitous effects of too great a precision and too great a decisiveness in political life. I'd argue that there are similar effects in personal life. My favorite my favorite hobby horse kind of to do you ride what do you do with a hobby horse do you ride it do you anyway my favorite kind of like whipping boy that sounds terrible is New Year's resolutions. They're just like they're grandiose. They're infrequent. They're sought out as much as for how they sound to other people as for how much they make us feel in doing them. You know, they're New Year's resolutions. It's theater. It's not real life. It's performance, right? And it's like, yeah, this is the thing I'm going to do. And then they don't work out. Everyone else, it's not working out for anyone else either. So we just kind of like shamefacedly don't talk about them. It's just wrong. It doesn't work, right? It's ineffective. Like I've written about before, it's like a gun that you can only fire once a year. And you don't get to choose really where to aim it because you're so focused on what everyone else thinks about the target you've picked. Like, it's just, like, that's not what you want. Like, what you want is, like, something shorter and sharper. It's like, can you imagine how difficult James Bond's job would be if he didn't have like his little pistol and That sounds terrible. Anyway, but you know, if he didn't have his, you know, his small arms or whatever other, you know, cool crap that Q gives him, whether or not it works. It usually works, doesn't it? My point being, you need like much more nimble tools. It's like New Year's resolutions. It's like trying to, it's like trying to draw a comic book with a log. You know what you really want is a pencil. Like you want finer tools to do this work. I can't even describe how dumb it is, but it's very dumb, rest assured. And so you don't need to lock yourself into like, this is what I'm gonna do, and this is life, and this is me forever. It's like, okay, calm down, chill, Winston, right? Just like, here, let's back this up a bit. Chill, Winston. You can proceed, you know, much more tentatively, much more tentative, not to say that timidly, just like more experimentally, right? Just like tinker forward to your gigantic goal. That's so. I mean, I want you to have goals that are so big you can't even say them out loud. Like they're just embarrassing. Like that's how big they. You shouldn't be able to announce them. They should be just out there, and you quietly move towards them. That's all you do. It's actually it's very simple. It's almost like a barbell thing, right? So you're working at just two extremes. You know, often we, but you're like, I'm sure you're thinking, well, you might be thinking, well, cats, what about middle ground? Middle ground is sometimes overrated. Like, what's it should you is what's the middle ground on how much poop you eat? I'm sure that there's like you have a zero tolerance policy on that, right? Like this, and so there is. I think there's a fallacy, right? I think it's called the fallacy of the excluded middle. Like, just because it's the middle doesn't mean it's right necessarily. It's I think that's what that fallacy is saying. I'll check actually. Okay, so I looked it up, and actually, the fallacy of the excluded middle is close to the opposite of what I'm saying, because it's saying there is a middle ground, and I'm saying sometimes you don't want the middle ground. Sometimes you want not either the two extremes, but both of the two extremes, right? So, and that's I guess that's called. So I guess what I'm arguing against is called an equidistance fallacy, or like a golden mean fallacy, or middle ground fallacy. Anyway, so that's that. So yeah, moving on. Here's one, another one from Gaddis. He goes, well, they're all from Gaddis, aren't they? Almost. The previous century had seen the Portuguese and the Spanish, neither hitherto seismically significant, exploiting a new understanding of ships, sails, winds, and currents to explore and conquer immensities of strange new things. End quote. That part's interesting for many reasons, not least of them being, well, the fact that the Portuguese and Spanish were not they weren't significant players for a long time. They didn't. It's so how this applies to us is you know you don't have to start out a big shot. What's the famous pithy saying? A big shot is just a little shot who kept shooting. So you you may be nothing now. It doesn't mean that's what you'll always be. You just keep accumulating experience points, right? And you can be great as well. Hopefully, in your case, it won't be through a genocide. So, but yeah. Seriously though, genocide's bad. Okay. So there are definitely some parts of this grand strategy that don't apply to us as individuals at all. I'm gonna bring one up here just to show you, like, not everything applies. Just you need to, like, you know, have your brain switched on, looking for the parts that do apply, and also, so you know, you don't want to kick it out, you know. Ignore it out of hand, like, oh, it's a book on strategy, nothing to do with individuals, but it's got a lot to do with individuals, but it also has a lot that doesn't. For example, back again to, you know, kind of this hagiography of Queen Elizabeth. She let her merchants risk their ships and settlers, but not her navy or treasury. She encouraged Drake, Sir Francis Drake, to spook the Spanish while under no illusion that his raids alone could secure her state. End quote. And that literally doesn't apply to us. We're generally, even the most Machiavellian of us are not so much in a position of where we're risking, where we're working with other people, you know, so that like we're making it so that they're risking their resources and we're not risking ours. It's not an issue that really applies to us. I just brought that up to, you know, don't know why I brought it up anymore, but I did. I need to highlight that, yeah, there's some parts here that don't apply. But let's go back to things that do apply. Quote, a heavy hand and a focused mind can appear to achieve monumentality, but only by smoothing out, if not flattening, topography, somewhat in the manner of Xerxes and modern highways. Assuming stability is one of the ways ruins get made. Resilience accommodates the unexpected. There can be reasons, therefore, for resisting uniformity, for respecting topography, even for dithering. End quote. This is important. There's this kind of, like, perfectionism, and I think, one of my college friends said this. He said, he had this idea that there, like, let's say, Japanese attracts, the Japanese language attracts, you know, among people who are not born into it, but chose it, people who choose Japanese, there's often a streak of perfectionism there. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that's, you know, rigorously, in the rigorous, like, statistical, almost like epidemiological sense true, but definitely in anecdotally it's very true. You get lots of perfectionists in the language game in general, in Japanese in particular, and it's not something you want. Like, for example, an example of trying to, like, just smooth everything out is I used to have this obsession with just making my SRS cards perfect. Everything had to be exactly formatted the same way. Like, it's weird, you know. I was very, I think it's weird now, looking back. Of course, it's what I mean. We've been schooled. What school's about making you into, kind of like a human factory good, right? Like, you're standardized in a way, making you into a standardized person. And so, of course, I wanted my study cards to be standardized too. It's ridiculous. Like, but now, you know, I appreciate all kinds of, you know, diversity. Even though, yeah, pretty much most of my, most of my core Japanese tech, for example, is MCDs, massive closed deletion cards. But, like, I'm not going to be like, oh, it's a different type. I'm not going to be obsessed with just over, you know, making things too perfect or too much the same. Even there's variation even within MCDs, right? Some are dictionary-based, some have furigana, some don't. Like, you know, it's very, I don't want to say shades of gray, but I'm going to say shades of gray. There's shades of gray, there's variation. There's, there are hills and valleys, if we're going to talk in topographical terms. And you want to be able to kind of, you know, roll the punches a bit more. Like, yeah, let's say a new card comes along, you don't want to be too bent out of shape, like too focused on doing things exactly the same way all the time, because that's what makes you brittle. And I see a lot of people, bless their hearts, they're humble, right? They're sunao. They come and they're like, they want the ajat methods, they want the ajat truth. They want that old-time religion, right? And so they want, like, they want these instructions they can follow to the letter. And it's like, I'm happy, but I'm also sad for them. Because, like, the idea is, it is to think for yourself. And it is to think, and not just in the sense of, oh, just creating something out of nothing. But it is to value your opinion and your feelings about things, and also your environment. Your environment's a real, you know, it imposes real constraints, and your environment's dynamic too. So there are things you can do on a train or in a car or can't do there are things you can do sitting at a desk that you cannot do on a commuter train, right? You cannot do in a car, you can't do while swimming. So you need, you want to adjust things to where, yeah, you know, maybe you have school to go to. So you want to be more, you want that resilience. And that, what does that mean? It's like, you want to be, as Bruce Lee might say, you want to be like water, you know, fluid like water, or moldable, like, you know, like blue tack, like sticky tack, malleable, I should say. Continuing with Gaddis. British America was a society whose political and administrative institutions were more likely to evolve from below than to be imposed from above. That made it a hodgepodge, but also a complex adaptive system. Such systems thrive, theorists tell us, from the need to respond frequently, but not too frequently, to the unforeseen. Controlled environments encourage complacency, making it hard to cope when controls break down, as they sooner or later must. End quote. You know, sooner or later, they're going to be, probably sooner, not really, that you find yourself in environments that are inconvenient. Like, you find yourself unable to do the perfect thing you planned out, like, all the time. But if you can fall back to the next thing, and if that doesn't work, you fall back again to the next thing. You just have, like, tons of fallbacks you can go through. There's so much you can do between, there's an infinite number of things you can do between, you know, perfect 100% quote unquote pure Asian Japanese and nothing. There's so much you can do, so many fallbacks. Just like there's an infinite number of numbers between, even between 0 and 1, there's an infinite number of numbers between them, right? Real numbers, that is, right? Not integers, obviously. So be resilient. This one's really cool. Suspicion of utopias and zealots, trust in common sense and experience, respect for tradition, preference for gradual change, and the view that compromise is victory, not betrayal, end quote. Compromising, doing the ajat you can do is better than doing the ajat you must do, or that you should do, right? Like, so there are all these perfect things you want to do. You're not a screw up because you don't do them perfectly. That's a win. You got something done. I don't even know how to tell you how much of a win it is. It's not just a win. That is almost, that basically is the definition of winning. That's real life winning. Real life winning is in that ground, middle ground, which we made fun of not so long ago, but in that middle ground between 0, which is useless, and perfection, and 1, which is perfection. In there is winning. So avoid rounding, harmful rounding. So rounding, you know, so you couldn't manage a 1, you got a 0.12, and you call it, oh, it's close to 0, that's a 0. No, it's not, it's a 0.12, it's a big deal, it's a big freaking deal. It's a really important line coming up next, then. This is where Gaddis is talking about Thucydides, about Pericles and King George III, specifically speech by George Grenville, who was King George III's first minister, I think that's the same as prime minister, at the time of the Stamp Act. So this is, kind of the events leading up to the American Revolution. And of course, Pericles, 5th century BC Athens. And here's the line from Gaddis on both Pericles and George III. He goes, "They lost the proportioning of things bought to prices paid." It's very important. Said it before, said it again, things do not have infinite value, so you don't pay infinite price. And of course, we don't have infinite resources, but we do have, what does that even mean to us? Infinite resources means everything we've got, period, just absolutely everything. Like there's no, again, things do not have infinite value, so do not give them infinite time. And so you limit the time right from the beginning. Don't even like let the time go crazy. You know, don't spend three years finding the perfect Christmas gift, right? Like 30 minutes will do, maybe less. I bring up the Christmas gift because actually that's one of Steve Pavlina's, I learned about time boxing from Steve Pavlina, stevepavlina.com, and he one of the first examples he gives is using it to like get over completely eliminate the stress of Christmas shopping. He's like, he's gonna do the best he can do in 30 minutes. I managed to apply that. Took a trip to, a trip to Korea, and I was like, gonna find, you know, souvenirs, but just like not stress over it. Like, we're gonna find, do the best we can do in half an hour and end it there. I'm not gonna spend like, you know, 2 days worrying and fretting and going back and forth over it. Again, it's because souvenirs are nice too, but they do not have infinite value. They don't have infinite value to me, they don't have infinite value to the recipient. So recognizing and then using that finiteness, putting our recognition into that finiteness and into practice is what's going to help us a lot. Okay, then in the book, Gaddis just has this long bit on the U.S., which the American Revolution, which really has, it's interesting, but it's completely irrelevant to us as individuals. So I'm going to skip that, and I'm going to skip ahead to this cool part. It's like sobering in a good way. Like, I know, like, you know, when you watch movies, or read history textbooks, it makes it sound like, you know, these generals knew what they're doing, and they don't. Let me explain how, which would seem to undercut what I'm saying, all this talk about strategy, but it doesn't. It's just, I think it just tempers it, and I think it'll it definitely makes me feel better. I think it'll make you feel better, too. So here it goes. In the heat of battle, it is impossible to tell what is going on at a given moment. continuing, on the weight of such unavoidably false reports, Napoleon gave his instructions, which either had been carried out before he ever gave them, or were not and could not be carried out. So, you know, it's a lot happens, you know, things a lot goes down, and so you don't need to be so hard on yourself. It's like that's a lot goes on. If you can make mistakes, you're not sure. Like it's even, I mean, so even history's greatest generals have had just trouble getting a grip on reality, and that's something in which you have an advantage over them. But even I think for us as individuals, it's not perfect, right? Like that's why movements like the quantified self are so important, because a lot of time do we really know what's happening? Like when you eat something, do you know what that does to your blood sugar really? Like you don't know. You don't have the, unless you have one of those constant glucose monitors, right? You don't actually know what's going on. You're kind of working on second, third, fourth, fifth hand information. You're kind of removed from the action in many ways, even though even though you're present. You're not necessarily on the ground, right? You're too far removed from it. Anyway. So continuing with Napoleon, he goes, the French had defeated themselves by exhausting themselves. This is Napoleon getting screwing himself in Russia, right? It's something we can do to ourselves too. We defeat ourselves by exhausting ourselves. We're wasting our energy on things that don't help and don't matter and aren't fun. So this whole discussion of Napoleon is actually part of his discussion of von Clausewitz, and who I think did von Clausewitz fight in the Franco-Prussian War or not? No, he's too young for that. He died in 1831. Yeah, so he didn't. But you know, France and Prussia had conflict before that, and in fact, yeah. So I think Gaddis talks about this, but von Clausewitz actually joined the Russian army to fight Napoleon, to fight the French. Which is neither here nor there. That's not even the point of any of this. The point of this is there's this really cool line. Too many theories, Clausewitz complains, try too hard to be laws. I really like that because I find a lot of times people would ask me Ajax questions like, look, they're looking for the law. What is the law? It's interesting. People like want very rigid rules. And then, interestingly enough, when they get them, they chafe on them, they hate them, but they want the security. They want very tight boxes, right? And, you know, even for me, when I wrote Nutshell, which is a summary of the Agent Method, even then it's like, I'm, not to undermine your confidence in it, but I'm not sure I believe everything that's in Nutshell. Like, I guess I do. Yeah, I mean, it's about right, but I understand, like, you want concrete actions to take, and I can give you those. And I feel like I have. And I'll give you some more if you ever want some more. I'll definitely give you those. But at the risk of, again, sounding grandiose, there's a deeper... you know, the world is... It's complex, right? So for me to say... I'm not going to say to you, like, if you wear red T-shirts, girls will like you. Like, it's not... There's a bit more to it than that, right? And it's not intractably complex, but it is. It's complex enough that... You know, reducing it to laws, I don't know. I have some physics envy, but not so much that, you know, I want these laws. I have like the three laws of language learning. That's kind of like the three laws of robotics. It's just there. I liked it at the time. I've never referred to it since. But it does. You need guidance, but you don't need. You don't quite even need a recipe. Oh, yeah, recipe is about as close. A recipe is about as much guidance as you need. Any more, like, I think we're treading on dangerous ground in that the fun of autodidactism, the fun of being an autodidact, and just the fun of life is kind of figuring out what works for you, what's fun for you. And so, again, like I said, it's frustrating because it's like, you just tell me what to do and, you know, and that'll be it. But that's not, how can I put this? That's not real. And there's a deeper reality. And if you take the time to look into that deeper reality, you'll find amazing things. There's a deeper reality inside life. There's a deeper reality inside you. There's what you want, what you're into. That's as clearly as like I'm having trouble being clear about my life of clarity, which is recursively funny if you think about it. Anyway, so Clausewitz, you know, he's not about laws, he's about heuristics, and he's like he'll avoid such nonsense and instead present ideas and convictions gained from years of thinking about war, much association with able men who knew war and a good deal of personal experience with it. These he'll convey in compressed form like small nuggets of pure metal. So von Clausewitz on war therefore benefits, as does Augustine's City of God, from flyover reading. You can't allow yourself to get stranded in what Sir Michael Howard has called Clausewitz's infuriating incoherence. It's not infuriating incoherence, it's just... The closest thing to it is like, your books of Chinese philosophy, just, it requires you to think as well. Like, what are you doing going into a book and when you just shut off your brain and just become like, it's not about, Clausewitz isn't about, he's not about, from what I haven't actually read On War myself. I think I read like a comic version of a comic, like a manga version of it, but I skimmed it. But, you know, he's not about creating clones of himself, you know, it's not that kind of operation. He's about making thinking adults, right? Thinking people. It's about you being an adult. Like, it's von Clausewitz isn't just like, he's not another place for you to plug in your umbilical cord, right? It's not what it's about. You can gain nourishment from it, but it's not just, here, von Clausewitz, I'm plugged in and just, now I'm part of you. You know, that's not what it's not. It's a, you can eat the food. He's laid out this repast for you. This buffet, right? And you go in and you pick stuff out, and that's I feel like that's a much more realistic learning paradigm what we have now, which is just like, you know, sit down, shut up, and become an automaton. So if you use the AJAT method, you're not just like an empty vessel for executing the AJAT algorithm. You know, I mean, that's kind of cool but kind of gross at the same time. It's not about making copies of me. It's about growing a new and unique, growing a unique you, in a unique way. I know that sounds cheesy, but it's true. Again, Gaddis, again, justifiably, banging on again about infinity. Quote, no European could have lived unastonished through or beyond the age of Napoleon. Astonishments haunted Clausewitz and Tolstoy, as did the conviction that they'd arisen from collisions between a universal law that although ends can be infinite, means can never be. End quote. The rest of the quote isn't important. The important is, although ends can be infinite, means can never be. That's really key. And then so Gaddis and von Clausewitz, mostly Gaddis, I guess, go on to describe how Napoleon basically, he, you know, there's a point where in the Russia campaign, that was, you know, more or less his undoing. He kind of, there was a point where he could have cut his losses and left, but instead he kind of doubled down on it. Kind of like, oh, this stock's going down. I guess I'll buy more of it, you know. And he lost big, right? Well, he didn't have to be. He became successful by being, you know, by being aware of the principle of proportionality. You know, that's where you don't risk, you don't invest more resources, more time or energy than something is worth, or more specifically, you don't invest infinite amounts of time, infinite amounts of worry, infinite amounts of energy, physical, mental energy, in something that is a finite value. So you proportion your means, proportion your, I guess, your ends to your means. Proportion or proportion? Anyway, you keep in mind that, you know, your resources are not infinite, and so you use them, I like this word, so I'm going to say it again, judiciously, right? You judge, you make smart and kind of economical conservative really decisions about your expenditures, when it comes to, again, time and energy, especially. In Napoleon's case, it's you know, soldiers, supplies, you know, lives, livestock. In our case, it's our time and energy. Those are what's most That's what's most universal, I think, for individuals. And so again, and Gaddis explains, why Spencer, why von Clausewitz, why Machiavelli, why they write more aphoristically. It's Machiavelli. He called it sketching, conveying complexity usably, because complexity fully rendered would take too long and contain too much, thereby entangling judgment. This is, again, body slam to perfectionism, any idea that perfection is what you're going to get. You can get very, very, very good, just not perfection. He goes, owing to friction, one always falls far short of the intended goal. And he was talking about, so your perfect plans, your perfect training, there's going to be imperfectionness. You accept it. You can reduce it. It could only be, 1% imperfection. It could be 3%, it could be 10%, it could be 1%, it could be 0.1%, but it'll be there. And you can keep working. Of course, reduce it, but you're not going to get to zero, but you're going to get it very low if you want, and you can get it really very, very, very low. But the point is to accept that it'll be non-zero. Your imperfection level will be non-zero, a number larger than zero. Stuff happens. I'm going to skip ahead a bit more, just give you some more choice words of wisdom from Gaddis. Not all praiseworthy things are simultaneously possible. Learning to live within that condition, let's call it history, requires adaptation to incompatibles. Here's another gem. Proportionality comes from what grand strategy is, the alignment of potentially infinite aspirations with necessarily limited capabilities. That's beautiful. Let's say that again. What grand strategy is, the alignment of potentially infinite aspirations with necessarily limited capabilities. So alignment. You want to be the very best, like no one ever was, right? And good, you can get how do you get aligned with that? Well, getting better, that's best. Better is aligned with best. It's in the direction. Improving is aligned, sucking less is aligned with best. They're in the same direction, right? They're parallel. They're parallel to each other. But in a way, there's this kind of perpendicular condition of limited capabilities, right? Of finite resources. And so there it is. It's there. You can keep pushing it back, but this, okay, so let's say, you can't see this, I'm actually playing with string and a couple of blocks here, so you can't see what I'm doing, but basically, so there's this parallel lines of better and best goes on to infinity, right? Better gets blocked here by this roadblock. Running perpendicular of limited resources, limited time, limited energy, limited tools, whatever. So there, but that's fine, that's okay, because you can even this barrier, the barrier of that perpendicular barrier of limitation. It's real, but it's not insurmountable. You can break through. There are many of these little barriers. You can break through many of them and keep going, going, and going. New ones come up, but you keep going. That's life. That's reality, right? That's it's cool. It's a good thing. So, I'm sure I've said this before. I've quoted this before. But David Deutsch, in his book The Beginning of Infinity, he goes, problems are inevitable and problems are solvable. I'm not sure that's the exact quote, but that's what he's saying. So either you're going to have problems, you're going to have limitations, but you'll solve them. You will solve. You can solve them. And then you'll get new limitations, right? New problems, and you'll solve them too. And then new ones will come. So they're always coming out. You're always getting better. But there's always a wall. But you're always getting better. So it's still good. It's good, okay, this is my favorite simple example is smartphones. Like, think of how much a smartphone's perfect. There's no such thing as a perfect device, but a smartphone's better than flip phones. I want to say in many ways infinitely better, right? Although I've just spent all this time poo-pooing the idea of infinity, but there's different kinds of infinity, and I guess you could say that then, and some of them are bad infinities and good infinities, and a good infinity is how much better smartphones are, how much more useful a smartphone is than a flip phone. And you get hipsters who are going back to flip phones for various reasons. They actually want a phone, blah blah blah, but it's smartphones are good devices. Let's be real, right? And again, but that doesn't mean they're perfect, right? They all have limitations. They all have things going. Maybe your Samsung is too responsive, the touchscreen is too responsive. Maybe, wish your iPhone could take your SD cards, or your iPad could take SD cards. Whatever the case may be, there's always something to improve. So that's your perpendicular wall there. Let's say they improve that, there'll be something else to improve too, and that's okay. That's the kind of our kind of infinite progression towards infinity, right? We just keep going, and that's where the fun is, that journey. Anyway, there's lots of good stuff in this book. I got a whole bunch of highlights, but that's the highlights of my highlights, if you will. And so yeah, On Grand Strategy by John Lewis Gaddis. Hopefully I'm getting his name right. I can't see it right now. And yeah, hopefully you enjoyed this recording. Again, I'm not very comfortable, talking rather than writing, but I thought it'd be fun to try. Fun for me and fun for you as well. Yeah, anyway, take care and talk to you later.